Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of April. This hour of the program, we ask a question that I'm sure many of you have thoughts about. Building a better teacher. How do we build better teachers? It was the focus of a very interesting article in the New York Times Magazine on March 2nd, and the author of the article, Elizabeth Green, is our guest this hour. Spencer Fellow in Education reporting at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and editor of GothamSchools.org. She covered the New York City Schools beat for the New York Sun and covered K-12 education nationally at U.S. News and World Report. And she has appeared on many programs to talk about education news. She serves on the board of the Education Writers Association and is a 2006 graduate of Harvard. We're welcoming phone calls for Elizabeth. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. What's interesting to me, and this is such a wonderful article, is that we haven't really done these thorough, exhaustive studies to determine how we should build teachers. I mean, we're just in the process of learning about this, even though people have been teaching for a long time.
Yeah, I think that is pretty surprising, although it's not that there hasn't been an interest in researching education or best practices in education. It's just that I think the research on teaching has proceeded slowly, and it's looked at kind of superficial things. Only now are we, in my view, getting into the real meat of the issue.
Mm. And what superficial things have we been looking at?
Well, I mean, and I don't mean to call them superficial and say they're not interesting at all, but I think, you know, there was some research in the 1970s where people would go in with clipboards into classrooms and look for certain behaviors and count, you know, the number of times the teacher talks, the number of times the students talk, and try to correlate that with how much learning happens. It's not that that's not interesting and important. It's just was sort of frustratingly, you know, non-prescriptive in the results. Not much came out of it, I think, that was super useful.
The other thing that we've been very confused about is how we determine how much learning is going on. And tell me what you discovered and what you're discovering in your learning in this area. Is it test scores that we've relied on? Is it what people ultimately do in their professions? It's a very difficult thing to judge.
It is. I think that's another one of the major challenges of researching education is how do you know if you've succeeded and how do you define success? I mean, certainly there's been a long conversation in our country, you know, going back to John Dewey and before about what do we want children to learn in school? Do we want them just to learn academic facts, or do we want them to learn skills, or do we want them to learn how to be democratic citizens? And then once you ask that huge question, you then have to ask, okay, how do we measure each of those, you know, maybe three or four or five things? And the most popular way to measure right now is certainly test scores, because we have more test score results than we've ever had. At the same time, the test score results are not really trusted by most academics for a variety of reasons. So it makes this problem even more challenging.
Mm-hmm. The people you interviewed who have studied all kinds of issues here, class size, merit pay, the background of teachers, how much education they have, are extremely interesting because above and beyond all of that, how students learn, how engaged they are, is determined, and you tell me by how large a measure, by how present a teacher is, by how a teacher can take command of a classroom, understand the needs of individual students, get them engaged so they're not wasting a lot of time trying to find their pencils and goofing
right.
around. And that's an interesting process.
Yeah, well, I think what the research shows is right now that if you look at what economists call the education production function, meaning the production of learning, mm-hmm. and you try to isolate the different variables that go into producing student learning, the one variable that has the most variation, so it has the most the strongest effect on student learning, is the identity of the teacher. But beyond the identity of the teacher, the next question is, and the question that's gotten less attention in the research is, why does one teacher produce more learning than another? What is one teacher doing that another's not doing? And so the people that I spoke to have different hypotheses, and they're doing really interesting research to try to answer that question. What are the isolated practices that one teacher uses that, you know, maybe we could export to classrooms around the country?
Right. And you're talking about significantly more learning, so that a really good teacher can take students, and it might be very poor students. It might be mm-hmm. students that don't they have merit-paid teachers, et cetera. It's just taking that by itself, they can really move them along so much more rapidly than a poor teacher.
Yeah, it depends on which study you look at, how much the difference is estimated, right, between two teachers. But in one of the most dramatic examples, the translation that the researcher gives is that the best teachers he found could move a student a year and a half's worth forward, so they might learn Algebra 1 and half of Algebra 2, say. They might master that. And then a poor teacher would only move a student halfway through 1 year's worth of material. So it's a pretty big difference.
And is that because the poor teacher didn't know the material very well, or the poor teacher didn't know how to take command of a classroom?
Well, I think that's the big question that needs to be answered. What distinguishes one teacher from the other? But the two answers that you present are the two sort of quick summaries of two researchers that I met with. One is a teacher who runs a set of schools in upstate New York. His name is Doug Lamov, and his hypothesis is that effective teaching has a lot to do with effective classroom management and effective ways to get students' attention. Another researcher is Deborah Ball. She's the dean of the University of Michigan Graduate School of Education, and she looks a lot at what teachers know, and she comes to some pretty surprising conclusions about what teachers need to know in order to teach.
What they need to know about their subject matters, or what they need to know about child development, or what?
About their subject matters and child development. That's kind of the interesting thing. So she did this interesting study where she's created this term called, she studies math teaching. She created this term called mathematical knowledge for teaching. This is her sort of list of things she thinks that math teachers need to know in order to be able to teach. And she gave a test of all of the things that she thinks math teachers should know, both to excellent math teachers and to professional mathematicians highly regarded in their fields. And she found that the math teachers actually did better than the mathematicians at this test, because the upshot is that there are certain things about math that a math teacher needs to know that not even a mathematician needs to know. It's a highly specialized skill to teach. Even to teach second grade math, you need to know a lot of intricate things about math, but also, and I think the key difference between what a mathematician needs to know, what a math teacher needs to know, is that you need to know how students are going to think about the problem, which is a huge area. If you think about it, a mathematician only needs to know how to prove, you know, his one theorem his own way. But 12 different people would possibly solve that theorem or think about the proof in their own way. So what the math teacher needs to be able to do is have a grip on each one of those proofs, each one of those 12 different ways of thinking about the problem, and then be able to get, you know, a room full of students, who each of whom thinks in a different way, all to take a grasp of the material at the same time in a limited you know, amount of time in their class with what, you know, and taking into account that there's probably a million distractions going on at the same time.
That is a tall order.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It is. And I think that's one of the most fascinating problems that we face, is that if, as we learn more about what it takes to teach effectively, we learn both that it seems that effective teaching is not just something people are born with. It is a set of skills that are learnable. But we also learn that the skills are really intricate and complicated and possibly hard to learn, even if you can learn them. And then you remember that we have, you know, 3.7 million teachers in this country. And the problem of how do we make sure that each one of them can teach effectively, given our limited resources, especially at this time, it's pretty vexing.
So give us an example. Maybe it's the teacher who got students excited about infinity in third grade and had some incredible explanations of that, or bad explanations of a teacher who was teaching things that were wrong that was in the article. You think, oh my goodness, you can't have a math teacher teaching things wrong here. But tell us about some standout teachers that mm-hmm. you discovered through writing the article.
Well, the woman that I'm telling you about, Deborah Ball, who's the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Michigan, is herself an exemplary teacher, a maestro teacher. And I've seen her teach thanks to the fact that her teaching was videotaped over the course of an entire school year. She was teaching third grade math in Michigan. And in East Lansing, Michigan. And the amazing thing about her teaching is that, in a way, the work that she's doing is invisible. And what you really focus on is these amazing statements coming out of the mouths of children. So she has these tiny little kids, you know, age 9, I think, saying, well, you know, I made this conjecture about even and odd numbers, and she takes them through essentially a proof of the fact that an odd number plus an odd number will always equal an even number. So the students, through the course of this class, together prove that that's true, and they use words like conjecture and I disagree with what my classmate said, and they just sound like little mathematicians. But, you know, it turns out when you learn about them, they're not, you know, it's not a gifted and talented class. Many of the students actually came from other countries not long ago. Some, you know, this is their first year in the United States. And yet, because of this masterful and yet slightly invisible teaching that Deborah Ball practiced, they are learning just a tremendous amount and at a very high level.
What do you mean slightly invisible?
Well, if you watch the videos, you hardly notice her. She'll sit in a chair on the side of the classroom, sort of nodding and quietly just encouraging students to talk. But when you explore a little deeper and ask her what her plan was for that class and how did she prepare and how did she get the students to talk this way, to talk about their conjectures and their ideas and proofs. It turns out that she has quite an extensive plan in mind and a certain way that she's doing this.
Mm-hmm. So many teachers complain that it's very, very hard to keep order in a classroom, and many are saying that it's much more difficult now than it ever was before, that students are so easily mm-hmm. distracted. They're listening to headphones, they're on their cell phones, texting people. They're just not engaged in the classroom. I'm interested in how the master teachers take command.
Yes, that is another fascinating problem. And the person that I spent a lot of time with, Doug Lamov, who's runs the schools in upstate New York, has a really great understanding of this, I think. He spent between 5 and 10 years traveling around the country to the classrooms of master teachers who were especially good at engaging their students in the material rather than getting distracted by a million different things. And the hard thing is to walk into one of these classrooms and you see every student writing down the notes with the teacher, raising their hand, interested, engaged, you think that this must be a magical teacher. But what Doug Lamov found when he looked a little bit closer, he actually videotaped these teachers and really studied their practice. He found that they were actually doing certain techniques, which he saw across many different styles of personality, styles of teachers, and many different kinds of classrooms, age level, subject matter, but they were all doing these same techniques. So I can give you a few examples.
Please, please. Everybody's saying in the audience, okay, let's hear them.
Okay, enough of that. One of the techniques is cold calling, which essentially means I ask a question to the 30 people in front of me, but rather than naming the person who I want to answer it, I leave it open and I call on someone without even that person raising their hand. So I say, I need to know what 3 times 5 is. And then I pause and then nobody's allowed to raise their hand and I say, Jasmine. This is a pretty simple thing to do, but if you think about the difference between putting a question that way and then instead saying, okay, somebody raise their hand
right.
and tell me what's 3 plus 5. There's a huge difference. When you say, somebody raise their hand and tell me what's 3 plus 5, a hand will pop up quickly, probably the kid in the class who always gets answers quickly. Everyone else will see that hand goes up and they'll think, I don't need to think about this problem. Joey is going to answer like he always does. On the other hand, if the teacher says, no hands are going to be raised, I'm going to call on one of you and I'm not telling you who it is, every single child in that class will think, oof, I have to think about the answer to that question.
Right.
And then I'm going to, because I might have to answer it. And so that's just one, and Doug Lamov calls that cold calling. I liked another of his techniques, this is a really tiny one, but it's called a self-interrupt, which means if you're the teacher and you're talking and suddenly you notice that Jasmine, again, is staring out the window and twirling her hair rather than paying attention, you, in the middle of your sentence, you stare at Jasmine without saying a word, and then the pause in your voice will ideally help that student realize that something is going wrong, and then you continue. So you never talk, you never allow yourself to be talked over or even to be ignored. And he has 48 other techniques like that, all with their little
He's writing
variation.
A book on this, isn't he? Is he the one who's writing the book on this?
Yeah, he has a book out right now.
Oh.
His name is Doug Lamov, Lemov.
Okay. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in a moment. Elizabeth Green is our guest. I'm sure many of you had a chance to see her piece in the New York Times magazine on March 2nd. Building a Better Teacher is the name of the article. She is a Spencer Fellow in Education Reporting at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And we welcome phone calls for her. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Catherine from Madison. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm going to put my headphones back on here.
Okay.
Am I there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. I think actually my comment dovetails a little bit with the last kind of observation that, was it Dr. Green? I'm sorry.
Elizabeth Green, yes.
I was just thinking that it might be valuable to, we could probably learn a lot and call upon some of the earlier research on both on parenting and on management, because I think there are a lot of common skills between that and good teaching. And I've observed both in terms of my own children's teachers and in terms of professionally I see teachers as clients that nobody really wants to talk about maybe personality, but management style, So teachers that are neither authoritarian nor laissez-faire, but know how to be respectfully democratic, And that probably includes some of those skills that Dr. Green just mentioned about, you know, kind of knowing how to keep people's attention without having to pound a gavel. Kind of attention to developmentally appropriate teaching. So, in other words, what's going to work for middle schoolers is probably quite different than what's going to be successful with third graders. And kind of, again, going along with management style, you know, non-shaming ways of trying, I mean, trying to control through shaming and through things like that, I think is incredibly destructive. And that, you know, shaping behavior, again, the way some of those previous examples were given. So I think some teachers just seem to be a natural, or they learn it and experience gives it to them. And interestingly, the parents line up on, sometimes these teachers aren't popular because nobody quite understands why they're succeeding, and there seems to be bad. I don't know why, but.
Okay, Elizabeth, your response.
Well, I think it's really interesting. First of all, thank you for giving me a doctorate. I don't have any kind of degree like that. I'm just talking about other people's research. But it's interesting what you say about bringing in thinking from parenting and management. I think that I've become really fascinated by the research about instruction, and the more I think about what these different people are finding, the more I think it's applicable to all kinds of different skills, like, you know, leading a discussion happens in many more places than just a classroom. It happens in meetings all the time. It happens in panels. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of overlap and a lot to be learned.
Thank you very much for your call. We go next to Art from Little Chute. Hi, Art.
Hi, good morning, and good morning to your guest. I can share a couple of things. I used to call on schools, and I worked with a company that was owned by the Stephen Covey Organization.
Mm-hmm.
We marketed student planners and things to the school, and mainly what the schools wanted them for was that we would also publish their rules about all the things that kids couldn't do in them. But as far as teaching kids how to use the planners, very, very few schools would actually do that. And what happens as a result, every principal that I ever sat down with, I asked about what are the key things he hears from his teachers as far as concerns go. And many of them were lost homework, late homework, grade suffering as a result of that. And when the kids got organized, they began to perform better, and they began to see themselves as better students, and it just carried over through a lot of different levels of their lives and lifted them up. But too often I would hear from a principal, I would introduce the concept of the planner, and they would look at me and they'd just say, my teachers will never do that. Hmm. And it was the saddest thing, because it was a simple, simple thing to do. It took less than 30 seconds out of every classroom period to get the kids to record what they needed to have done. But too often when I was putting on these seminars for teachers and showing them how to use the planners, the teachers would all gather at the back of the room and just talk the whole time. They never listened to anything that was going on, and they never took anything seriously. You had no uniformity of expectation throughout the school, and that mm-hmm. was a problem. And one other point that I think is huge in schools is one of my most successful principals told his teachers, yeah, math departments can have tests on Tuesdays. Science departments can have tests on Wednesdays, social studies classes can have tests on Thursdays. You got kids that are frequently running up against five tests in one day because nobody coordinates anything. The teachers don't talk to each other, and it's from grade level to grade level, sometimes with the teachers within a single grade, and it certainly doesn't carry over from the middle school into high school as to what the expectations are in getting the kids ready for middle school. So there's a lot that teachers can do that are very simple steps, but they've got the union behind them, and they just don't feel they need to do anything, and therefore they don't.
Elizabeth.
I think one observation that would ring true no matter who you talk to, whether it's the teachers union leader or the person who's most resentful of teachers, is that teachers in their individual classrooms are incredibly isolated from one another, and there isn't much enforced way of them talking to each other across their classrooms and collaborating and saying, how can we coordinate together? How can we learn from each other? How can we have a standardized practice across the building? And the best schools that I've been in are open walls. The teachers are constantly walking into each other's rooms, talking to each other, sharing ideas. They have certain standards that they all, to some degree, follow. I don't think it's fair necessarily to blame teachers unions directly. I think there's a long history in our country that also explains why teachers are so isolated. And we started with a one-room schoolhouse, and where a teacher would sit alone with a bunch of kids without much observation at all. And we expanded on that model. Researchers call what we have now the egg crate schoolhouse. Each teacher is their own little egg surrounded by those brown little walls.
And it's pretty intimidating. You focus on a couple first-year teachers to walk into a classroom, and many are very young, and to gain the attention of your students and to move forward is not a very easy thing to do. We need a set of skills before we walk into that environment if we're not going to get a lot of support from other people.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's the most, I can't imagine something more frightening, to be honest, because there you are and you're responsible for these children's learning. And now we know just how much of a role you can play in their learning. I mean, beyond what's intuitive, we know that it shows up in the best way we have to measure learning. They either learn or they don't, and it's in your hands. So I think there's some exciting work going on around the country to say, Let's think about the problem of our schools as a problem of teacher preparation. I mean, there's lots of other issues to consider, and I'm not saying that those aren't important, but let's think about a way that we can effectively and, you know, not too expensively prepare teachers for the immense challenge they have when they walk in front of those 25 little minds.
If not 35 or 40. All right, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Paul next from Green Bay. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for having this discussion. I think it's important that more people think about these things. But my comment was more about the evaluation side and how complex I think the equation of education is. And I think scientists really like to study things with smaller amounts of variables. It makes it easier and, you know, it's just handy for the science and the math. But I think education is so entwined with our culture and the personalities of not only the teacher, but the students that make up a classroom and the administration that makes up a school and a district, that I think it's really difficult to find factors and isolate them and say, this is what's most important or that is what's most important, because there's things outside the school that have a huge influence as well. And it's hard for me to imagine how you can study things uniformly and make predictions when even our cultural norms about how we treat well-educated, smart kids and how they're represented in our culture and media has a big impact on how things go in the classroom. So I just, you know, I'm a second profession teacher, and just the things I've noticed in my classroom are really hard to pinpoint as to what works and what doesn't. Some years, one lesson works fabulous. Another year with a different class, it might flop. It's very difficult to predict. Mm.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't want to underestimate. I don't think anyone should underestimate the challenge of the problem. I think one of the interesting things to watch in the next several years is school districts around the country are being encouraged in various ways to come up with systems to evaluate their teachers. When I talk about the research I see, it's not with an eye toward evaluation, all of it. Some of it is just trying to figure out the best practices. But the next step then has to be somebody comes into the teacher's room and says, are you doing this or not, and how can we help you do better? Some of the evaluation tools that are being created are based on observations. Some of them are just based on test scores. So there is going to be a big debate in this country in the next few years. We're already having it about what do we want to evaluate our teachers for and how do we want to do it and how can we afford to do it?
Thank you so much, Paul, for your call. We go to Jeffrey from Pewaukee. Hi.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking
it's
my
Kathleen,
call.
It's Kathleen, but that's all right.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
yeah, I just have a comment concerning this program and your previous program. You just had a program that promoted the spending of billions of dollars to put a few humans on the moon or even Mars. And it's my understanding that there are more African-American men of college age in prison than in college. And I just feel that funding that's being proposed for spending a few people to interplanetary space could be a lot better spent on education, and maybe your caller could comment on that for us.
I think I can say that federal spending on education doubled in the last year. It's still obviously a relatively small share of federal spending, but at the same time, the commitment is from the Obama administration has actually been made analogous to space spending. The major program, or one of the major programs that Arne Duncan, Obama's education secretary, announced was called the Race to the Top. And calling it the Race to the Top was an explicit reference to space. He said, I want this announcement to be considered parallel to the challenge, go to the moon. Instead of the moon, it's equal or excellent education for all students. So it's an interesting analogy that you bring up.
We go to Jill next from Cedarburg. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things I'd like to comment that Elizabeth stated was the isolation in the open classroom concept. And I do agree about the isolation, but the open classroom concept that we had in the Cedarburg schools here made it hard for the children to concentrate. Hmm. There were too many things going on that... it was just very hard. So they ended up in the middle school here to put the walls back up. But
well,
I
can
do
you explain
agree.
What open classroom meant for your school?
They had open classroom concepts in the middle school, yes.
So there were literally no walls?
They were called pods. And they were, yes, sections of, yeah, there were no walls. There were some sections so that there were, I think there were three or four teachers, like, in each group. And they used bookshelves or different things to demarcate each classroom.
And what was the point?
The point was way back when, the open classroom concept, like you said, was for less isolation, easier movement possibly between one class. Let's say one teacher taught science better than another teacher. Another teacher was better at math.
Right.
They could move within that area, yet not disturb other areas, or the teacher could move to where that classroom was.
When I talk about the effective schools that I've seen, they all have walls around their classroom. What they have is an open door policy. I'm sorry if I misspoke, but teachers will come in and out of the classroom, and the students actually don't seem distracted at all by adults coming in and out just to observe their class.
And
I can totally see how that would be distracting,
right,
to have another class going on right next to you. I've talked to teachers who've had to teach in that kind of circumstance, and it sounds hellish.
Yeah. Thanks, Jill, for the call. Here's an email that's come in. Recruiting high-level thinkers to the teaching profession is critical. There are too many teachers who are not learners themselves, and I know there's been some research on the cream of the crop who have been recruited, like places like Teach for America, but still, even if they're high-level thinkers, they're not necessarily great teachers.
That's true. The research on Teach for America is mixed. Some studies have shown that Teach for America teachers outperform other teachers, and it depends on the age of the students and the subject matter. But that said, the solution that Teach for America presents, which is they recruit from top colleges, the top students from top colleges, certainly even, you know, Teach for America would admit has not solved the problem of effective teaching. In fact, Teach for America, even with all of these bright minds, has moved toward the thinking that, you know, being bright is not enough. You have to master certain practices. They call them leadership qualities. It's just their own different theory. It's pretty interesting in and of itself, constructed by one of their master educators, Stephen Farr, who also has a book out. But yes, I think, but getting back to what the caller said about teachers needing to be learners, I think that's a pretty powerful way to think about what makes an effective teacher.
Yes.
If you want to unite the different kinds of theories that I've talked about today, thinking about your own practice and constantly retooling based on the results you see has to be one of the common threads.
Mm-hmm. And what's in it for you to do that? Obviously, it's just a good way to live, but can we look at the system of rewards for teachers who do all of that extra work to be really good at what they do? Are they rewarded? Does it merit pay make a difference here in keeping the better teachers in the profession?
Well, first of all, note, in general, teachers are not rewarded. In general, teachers are treated, when reports said, like widgets. It doesn't matter really how good they are. They generally get the same pay scale and the same leadership opportunities as everyone else at their school. The only factor that matters across the board, across the country, is how many years of experience you've had. So that said, merit pay is this really popular idea for how to change that equation a little bit and reward better teachers. It's happened in districts across the country. The results, again, have been mixed. I think one of the challenges is finding programs that reward this exact kind of response to change and becoming a better practitioner. Some of the programs simply look at, did your students score higher on tests than any other teachers? And that's kind of a limited measure, I think.
We continue more phone calls for Elizabeth Green in just a moment. We're talking about building a better teacher, the focus of her lengthy and very interesting article in the March 2nd issue of the New York Times Magazine. She is a Spencer Fellow in Education Reporting at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and the editor of GothamSchools.org. And our phone number, our lines are busy, but keep trying, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller, Fred from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. A couple comments to make. One of the things, I graduated as a teacher but never taught ever, partly because of poor pay. The student teaching, I think, is the most important part of a person when they're going to be a teacher. That's right at the end of their four-year curriculum. And yet it's only 9 weeks long. To me, that's woefully inadequate to start out in a classroom with. To me, it should be at least a semester, if not a year. So that's one comment I have, is on the student teaching. The other thing is, I always believe, like a firefighter, a policeman, or a teacher, if they're teaching in an inner city school, which is probably the schools which aren't meeting standards and such, that those people should really receive a significant bonus for teaching in those schools. Otherwise, what happens is the teacher gets seniority and they opt out and go to a suburban school. And who replaces them? Probably a teacher fresh out of college with no experience. So that's one comment. And then the other thing that's sad, and I'm sure it's everywhere in the United States, here in Wisconsin, is that you read where this pay is frozen, benefits are being taken away, teacher layoff, classroom size increasing. All these things are detrimental to learning. So those are my comments, guys.
Thank you very much, Fred. Elizabeth.
Well, he's raising two issues. The first, the issue of encouraging teachers to go to the inner city. Two points that I think are interesting. One is that differences in teacher effectiveness happen across all income sector. So in suburban schools and in urban schools, I think that's pretty fascinating. You could have just as much variation in a suburban school where things seem to be pleasantly moving forward as in an inner city school. That said, I think there's certainly a lot of reasons, some research among them, to think that it's important to attract the best teachers to inner city classrooms. And there are some exciting programs happening where teachers receive a bonus in pay in order to go to an inner city classroom. Not sure about every part of the country, but I know that's happening in New York City where I live, and it is happening elsewhere too.
Thank you, Fred, so much for your call. Tim from East Troy, hi.
Yes, hello. I had three comments that we need to do to create a good teacher. One, we need to respect them for the people that they really are. Two, we need to pay them a respectful wage because they're like at the bottom of the list right now. And three, we need to build and maintain our schools so they have a decent facility to work in. And I think if, you know, people in this country don't understand that we can build all the prisons we want, and it doesn't seem to be a problem, but we won't spend any money to support our schools and build those schools so our teachers and children have a decent place to learn.
Elizabeth.
I think those are pretty good points. At the same time, spending on schools has been climbing steadily over the last 50 years, and yet our results are still poor. So I think a lot of people are saying that rather than think about simply paying teachers more, putting more money into school facilities, we also have to think about why did we spend so much more over the last 50 years and not get any better results?
Yeah. What about this issue of respect? I think that this is an important issue. There are other professions. You go to the doctor usually and you're listening carefully to every word. You have an enormous amount of respect for that profession. Most people do. You have a teacher, and so often teachers are just not given, as a society, they're not held in high esteem. And I just think it's one of the most crucial professions there is. Do you think we have a problem in that regard?
Yes, and I think it's a really interesting problem to think about because there's a lot of different factors going on. I think one of the most fascinating things I learned in reporting the story is that this tension between, on the one hand, everyone agrees that education is important and that teachers are an important part of our society. I think probably 99% of people agree with that. And on the other hand, they're not held in high esteem. You know,
yes.
It's common for a parent to say, "What are you're going to go off and become a teacher? Why don't you do something? If you, those who can do, those mm-hmm. can't teach." But I was fascinated to find that this sort of tension between holding in high esteem and not respecting teachers has been a historical pattern since colonial times. So in colonial times, we think of teachers mainly being women. Then teachers were all men. They were young, and they were some of the smartest people in in the area, but they also were young and they were teaching on their way to doing something else. It wasn't the end goal. It was some path toward better, higher things. I think one of the reasons for this long-term historical trend is that while everyone values education, we also have this resource problem where there are so many more teachers needed in a society than any other professional, white-collar job. There, as I said, 3.7 million teachers in this country. That is a size that dwarfs anything that you could think of that might
yes.
be similar category. Nurses, secretaries. There's more teachers than that.
You include that the number of architects. It's only, 180,000 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but medicine, doctors, you might think, why can't teaching profession be like the medical profession? Well, there's about, five times as many teachers as there are doctors.
Yes.
Or way more than that. I'm bad with these numbers, but.
Yeah. But if you look at the article, there they are. So
they are.
Thanks, Tim, very much for your call. Let's go next to Scott from Madison. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
This is such a wonderful topic. I've got so many things I could talk about. I do want to touch first on, I think an earlier caller mentioned that some student teaching is only 9 weeks long, and that's true. But I'm a former teacher and current education professor here in Wisconsin, and I just want to point out that some student teaching is a year long. It just does depend on the program you're in and also your major and a variety of other factors. But the main reason I'm calling is because I'm a professor of measurement and assessment, and in most of the classes I teach, are on how teachers can evaluate their students and also how things like standardized tests are used to then evaluate them.
Fascinating.
And I think, as probably both of you know, in Wisconsin, they recently passed a law allowing competition for Race to the Top money that said that teachers in the state could be evaluated with their students' test scores, but they may not be suspended or fired based on their students' test scores, which I think has good and bad things. But what I'm really concerned about is the fact that in the psychometrics world where we make these assessments to evaluate our students' skills, they are not designed to evaluate teacher effectiveness. There is an inherent process that is undertaken that is not designed to evaluate the educator. There's simply too many variables that come into play. As another caller mentioned, there's just too many variables for us to be able to say, high test score, good teacher, low test score, bad teacher. It's just not that simple. And I'm very worried about that kind of practice and how it might drive people away from the field, might drive some very passionate teachers out of a job they might be doing a very good job at, but just because their students have not yet reached kind of an arbitrary proficiency level, that those teachers are basically labeled as ineffective.
Mm-hmm. Good points.
Elizabeth. Yeah, I'd love to add to that. I think, Kathleen, you mentioned that in my story I write about a teacher who was observed and videotaped giving the wrong math information to her math class, and she was very charismatic. She seemed like a great teacher. She was connecting with the kids. They were all paying attention, but she taught them the wrong thing. Pretty upsetting. And in fact, when she was evaluated based on her test scores, on her students' test scores, with this kind of psychometric measurement called value added that I'm sure this caller is referring to, she was rated a good teacher in the 75th, I think, percentile. So still a lot of kinks, I think, to be worked out in these measures,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Yeah. Do you think that we need, what kind of study do you think that we need, in addition to what we've been talking about, to determine, Scott, what makes a good teacher?
I think there have been a lot of interesting studies that have gone out and looked at some of the things that your guest has mentioned about that have gone out and looked at master teachers. And there's also been some interesting studies that have looked at what do teachers do who are rated by their students as being appealing. And so we've actually asked students and said, tell us how your teachers stand as far as appeal, challenge, choice, meaningfulness, and self-efficacy and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers have gone out and looked at those teachers and said, what is it that these teachers are doing that makes them so popular, almost just from a PR perspective? And it's not that they're easy and that they're, a laughable kind of guy or girl who doesn't teach anything. It's that they're challenging, they're engaging, they link the content to their students. It's not just lecture, it's participatory learning.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of things that we do know. And I think a lot of those are being implemented. I think, as your guest kind of pointed out, though, there's just such a variety of students out there and such a variety of educators that there's not one recipe that's going to make for good teaching for everybody. It's just not the case. And I think the sooner we kind of get past that in the mainstream, kind of the popular conception, I think the better off we're going to be.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. I'm glad you were listening today. Elizabeth, tell me about the studying that you're doing. We have about 30 seconds left. You're studying education reporting.
Oh, I well, this fellowship was created to get education reporters to learn more about education research.
Oh.
It's a pretty cool thing. It's sponsored by the Spencer Foundation based out of Chicago.
Great. Well, keep looking at all of it. It's fascinating, and it is so important, Elizabeth, isn't it? It is. You can't underestimate how important all of this is.
I agree with you, and I just hope that I can talk to more people like Scott and learn more about this research and pass it on to
yeah.
the public.
Well, I'm sure he'd love to hear from you further. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Elizabeth Green, Spencer Fellow in Education Reporting at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, editor of GothamSchools.org. Her article, Building a Better Teacher, appearing in the March 2nd edition of the New York Times Magazine. And Scott from UW-Madison, if you want to get in touch with Elizabeth, get in touch with us in some way, and we'll link the two of you because she's doing all of this study. Okay, thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.